Good morning. Welcome to Ideas and Issues. I'm your host, Hugh LaFollette. My guest this morning is Paul Wagoner, scientist at the Agriculture Experiment Station in Connecticut. And our topic is agriculture and population. Paul, glad to have you on the show.
Thank you for asking me and for allowing me this great convenience of remaining in New Haven and being interviewed in Johnson City.
What I want to do is, here we are on the edge of the millennium, we're thinking about what it's going to be like to move into the 21st century. And one of the questions concerns the population and the ability of the land to support the population. Perhaps to give us a little bit, the listener, a little bit of perspective, maybe you could begin by talking a little bit about what some of the early predictions were about population and our ability to feed people.
The classic, most famous prediction about the balance between population and food was made by a gentleman by the name of Malthus, M-A-L-T-H-U-S, back around 1800. Young Malthus felt his father was too taken with the ideas of the French Revolution and the constant improvement of conditions, and so Malthus said population will multiply, agriculture will only add, and the two will collide, causing starvation unless population is otherwise limited by disease or war. That prediction made to disillusion his father by Thomas Malthus has continued to influence our thinking now for 200 years. It's interesting to remember that when Malthus made his prediction that people would soon run out of food, the population of the world was less than a billion. If he was startled or frightened or transfixed by the idea of population overwhelming our ability to feed ourselves, I suppose he would be scared out of his mind now that we stand at about six times as many people on the earth as there were back when he was impressed in 1800, the time of Napoleon. That surely is the preeminent prediction about the balance between population and food, and it is. Malthus is so famous that anyone who thinks that we will outrun our food supply is called a Malthusian today. So that's the preeminent prediction about the balance between population and food, and it has come and it has gone for 200 years.
Now, let me ask, as I understand it, it's been a long time since I've read Malthus, but his earlier predictions would have already had us at considerably larger than 6 billion population, I believe. And he would have, certainly by his accounts, the Earth would not be able to support even 6 billion people. To that extent, it appears he's wrong, and yet there is some kind of important connection between population, food, and land. And I wonder if you could generally describe what that relationship is.
Well, there certainly is. And in understanding that connection, we can understand why Malthus's prediction has not been realized. If we were on television and I would write on a chart that a ratio, on the top of the ratio would be population multiplied by the amount of food each person consumes or has available, and dividing that would be the yield of food per acre. So then the ratio is population times food per person divided by the yield. So when population doubles, if neither one of the other factors in that ratio change, we'll either have to have more land, we'll have to cultivate more land, or the food per person will go down. That was what Malthus saw, and that's what frightened him. Of course, the reason his prediction has not been realized is that there's more to the ratio, and that is it is divided by the yield of food per acre. And so although population has gone up, yield has also gone enough that we're actually eating better than we were when he made his prediction. So that is the connection between population and food and agriculture in the form of the yield. And that is also the explanation of why Malthus's prediction of an apocalypse has not been realized.
Okay, maybe you give us a bit of a... I mean, I think that formula is very important. We're going to come back to it. But perhaps trace out what the history has been, the percentage of... I mean, roughly,
yes.
The percentage of land used in agriculture, now versus the 1800s when Malthus made his predictions, and also the question of yield, because both those are things we want to come back and talk about later.
The history of the land for agriculture is one that began, let's begin with Malthus in 1800, Thomas Jefferson, Napoleon, in that era. During for the next 100 to 150 years, the amount of land used by agriculture expanded. It expanded so fast with the opening of the American West and the provision of transportation to bring food out of there and put it into international trade, the wheat from Kansas and other states on the way as farming expanded. That went on so rapidly that the food supply expanded so fast that there was an agricultural depression, and there was a slide in food prices beginning in around the time of the American Civil War that has continued to this day. Now, that expansion of the land for farming, however, came to a halt around 1950, around the time of the Second World War. And since that time, the amount of land for each person has been slipping because the amount of land farmed has been more or less steady. It's gone up maybe one part in eight in the developed world and one part in four in the poorer world. But it has generally, because the total has stayed constant, population has continued to rise, the allotment, if you will, of land for each person has gone down, and it's gone down pretty sharply since about 1950. And it's gone down mainly because yields have gone up sufficiently fast that we've been able to spare that extra land that would otherwise have been cultivated.
I mean, according to that, you said we're eating better than we were in Malthus's day, despite the fact that we have six times as many people, and despite the fact that we're not actually using proportionally as much land for agriculture as we were in those days.
And by proportionally mean per person.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, despite that, there is a considerable anxiety about our ability to feed the increasing populations, even though, if anything, we're actually having agricultural surpluses. What's the source of this anxiety?
Well, as if there are some farmers there in Tennessee and Virginia and maybe even Kentucky listening to us, they know that the problem has been surpluses, not shortages, throughout their careers and even their father's career as a farmer. And certainly prices of agricultural products right now are really in the cellar, testifying to this abundance of food. But you're quite right, the fear of Malthus being right, the fear of a collision between population and agriculture causing us to go hungry persists. And I have often reflected how this can be. How can our fears persist? And I think there are one foundation is we're simply afraid of being overrun by more populous groups. The French feared the Germans back in the 19th century and tried to encourage population growth, but the French were the first to stabilize their population. And so I think we do fear growing population for many reasons, and so an argument for slower population growth is attractive to us. And then we frequently see pictures of starving, bloated, suffering people, hungry. That keeps this vision alive of hunger, even though amongst a bit abundance. And then finally, we do know land is finite. That's, I think, a saying attributed to somebody like Mark Twain, a bit of wisdom that they're not making any more land anymore. So all of these things, these factors, the knowledge that it does take land to grow crops, all of these keep our fears alive, and in some ways our fears are justified because we are depending on that divisor in the ratio, the yield of food per acre, to keep us well fed and at the same time not demolish nature by the expansion of our cropland. So I think that's why, despite an abundance of food, despite falling prices for food, despite the obvious hardships of the farmers who are being driven to the wall by an abundance and low prices, that's why the Malthusian fear still stays alive.
Okay, I'd like to pursue some of those questions. Before we do, though, I'd like to pause briefly for the benefit of anyone who may have tuned in late. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest this morning is Paul Wagoner, scientist at the Agriculture Experiment Station in Connecticut, and we're talking about agriculture and population. Now, you've talked quite a bit already about yield, and that's obviously an issue that we're going to discuss quite a bit in the remaining of the program. But when we think about yield, has yield gone up equally throughout the world? I mean, part of what motivates the question is you talked about hunger amidst abundance, the fact that there are, at least in parts of the world, considerable starvation, which would suggest that yield is going up in the developed countries, perhaps, but maybe not elsewhere.
Well, that is the pictures we see on television from Africa, and our own pride in our state of development and our ability to accomplish things technologically do make us feel that these rising yields are a feature of Tennessee and Iowa and Illinois and places like that, and not in the rest of the world. But that, surprisingly, that's not at all true. As a matter of fact, the agricultural production has gone up faster in the developing world than it has in the developed world. The poor countries as a whole have improved their situation faster than we have for the past 30 years or so. The Asians, who comprise more than half of the world's population, have done very well in improving their food supply. The famines were once associated with India. The Indians are doing very well, thank you. I don't mean that they're as rich as they would like to be or as well fed as they would like to do, but compared to where they were, they have improved tremendously. And they have not only improved in their total production, but in their production per capita and especially in their yield per acre. So this progress in feeding people on less land is widespread. There is one glaring exception, and that is Africa. A problem in much of Africa is that there's simply no reason for, or it's very difficult for a farmer to improve his farm when he's being overrun by warlords from time to time. So Africa suffers very badly from disorder, and accompanying that disorder, decreasing agricultural production. Most of the food problem of the world, if we continue our research and development, most of the food problem of the world is centered in Africa. To make the point, I would point out that some of the largest rises in wheat yields are, in fact, in Africa, in Egypt. So where there is order rather than disorder, the Africans have done well, the Asians are doing well, and so by steady application of research and the encouragement of farmers by good government policies, the rest of the world is doing as well as Iowa or Tennessee, with that terrible exception of Africa.
Yeah, that's very intriguing. Now, I'm actually going to toss out effectively two questions here, and you can sort of take them in either order. One goes back to something you said earlier, just as an aside comment, but it's worth developing, that you said that part of the concern is not just the ability to feed the people. Part of the concern is the ability to feed the people in a way that does not completely consume all our land. And by that, so you mean completely consume all wilderness land, all parkland, all land that's being set aside for nature and for human enjoyment. I suppose the overarching question is, what are the reasonable predictions or projections about our ability to feed future people, especially if we continue to think it's important to keep substantial chunks of land set aside as wilderness area?
How do you do it? Can you do it? And why would you do it? You might put it that way. The taking the why to do it first, the classic reason for wanting abundant food production is to feed ourselves. But in our generation, certainly, there has been an additional reason added for feeding ourselves on with a more efficient agriculture, and that is the higher the yield, and I'm using yield for a whole lot of factors, but the higher the yield that divides into the population and the food per person, in that ratio, the higher that yield, the less land we have to take. And the less land we have to take, that means the more that is left for the natural world, for Mother Nature. And so in addition to our goal of feeding ourselves, well, we now have the additional goal that may not have affected people 100 years ago, and that is we want to feed ourselves well and still spare land for the natural world. Now, the second question is, can we keep it up? Can we continue to raise yields, thus spare this land? That depends, first of all, on where the population levels out, and we can come back to that again, but let's say it's going to level out someday soon. Then I think what we have to do is to ask whether or not we can double again or triple our present yields. I don't know. It depends upon continued pressure on the research fund front. We mustn't let our present success and prosperity ever let us stop that effort. And the second thing is we have to have government programs. We have to have economic incentives that cause farmers to do their best. Given that, I would simply, as far as to show there is a possibility for this, I would point out that American corn yields are many-fold the world average, although the world is rising. Still in all, we grow a lot more corn per acre than other countries, and I'm sure they are just as smart as we are, and with time, and if they have a orderly and helpful society as we do, I'm sure they too will get up near our records. Now, whether we can raise our yields or not is another question. The U.S. average corn yields are now around 100 bushels per acre. That is a long ways from the maximum of 300 and some that farmers do grow when they do the best they can. So I think we know why we want to continue to raise yields. It is not only to secure our own food supply, but to do it with the least land, to spare the most land for other uses. I think there is latitude for us to continue raising our yields, barring some surprises that we could talk about. And so I'm reasonably hopeful that we can make it to, say, a population of 10 billion if we had to.
What are some of those surprises you're talking about? And I take it by surprises, you mean things that could hinder productivity and perhaps also things that might enhance it.
Yes. Yes, I think we must remember that there are bad surprises, like stubbing your toe, and there are good surprises, like a birthday party. So there are both kinds. I think the population expansion is definitely slowing. The population growth in Bangladesh, which is a case that is often cited, is about half of what it was in the early 1960s, and it's about half, and it's about equal to what our rate of population increase was in this country in the 1960s. India's population growth has fallen by about a fourth. Our population growth is down to about a third of what it was in the 1950s, right after the Second World War and the baby boom. And there are countries in Europe and from the nation of Japan that are actually facing shrinking populations. So I think one of the surprises is that we may never get to the 10 billion. And that, of course, will make it easier to feed ourselves and make it easier to spare land for nature. Another good surprise that may come along is breakthroughs, and certainly genetic engineering has opened up a whole new era that we've not really begun to sense what it'll do for us yet. But then there are some bad things that can happen. New pests, new bugs, new fungi, new diseases can arise. We simply have to be alert for those and cope with them, because they are always surprises. They're not the standard diseases that cause us trouble. There are new diseases that come along. We must have a fire department, if you will, ready to control them. that same research establishment that we have to have going anyway to keep pushing up the yields. And then there's climate change, which is on everyone's mind, not only because of the rising carbon dioxide in the air, but because of what's happening in a belt from here in Connecticut to Missouri right now in a very dry, hot summer. Those high temperatures are uncomfortable, but they're not as difficult for a farmer to cope with as changes in rainfall. And we simply don't know what changes in rainfall might occur with a climate change. So those are that's the good news and the bad news.
Okay, we've got about 5 minutes here, and there are probably more issues than we can afford to cover. But let me toss out at least a couple of questions, and also feel free if at some point you want to make to jump in. If we want to go back to your original formula, you had people times the amount of food they eat divided by the number of acres in production times the number the amount of yield per acre. And the one thing we've not talked about here is the amount of food or the amount of calories consumed. The temptation is to assume that what that means then, the only way in which that factor comes into play is if we just eat less food, perhaps we all go a little bit hungry. Are there other ways, though, in which we can change or affect that factor?
Yes, there certainly are. the amount of food per unit of agricultural production has, in fact, been going down. And that I didn't put in that refinement I didn't put in the ratio that I talked to you about. Thing that people grasp quickly is that if you eat animal products, the animal is going to take in more calories than yields in food. And so vegetarians, if you will, enjoy pointing this out. It is true to a degree. Certainly poultry are more efficient converters of feed into meat than our swine, and swine are more efficient than cattle. But there are some definite provisos in that. First of all, the animals eat very high-yielding crops like corn, and second, the grazing animals convert things into meat that we wouldn't eat. So there is some room for modification of the amount of the relation between the food per capita and the yield, because we can eat different things. Another thing that has happened is that in the world as a whole, the amount of food per unit of cereals, which is the backbone of food production, has been changed by the fact that as people get more calories, they begin to branch out and get better diets, more diverse diets. And so, in fact, the changes in diet amongst different kinds of meat, between cereals and vegetables, all of those modify the food per capita that is allowed with the given agricultural production. So there's, and all of the changes in that direction have in fact been helpful to sparing land.
Okay, in the last minute and a half here, maybe it'd be helpful if you just try to sum up what you thought would be the most important message you would like to leave to the listener about this, what we face, and about the relationship between agriculture and population.
Well, the relation between agriculture and population is in that ratio, population times food per person divided by the yield of food per acre. And so if a person keeps that in mind, they will see that there's not one, there's not two, but there are three factors that affect the amount of land that we require to feed ourselves. The second thing is, in the case of surprises, the thing that I think can seriously inhibit our ability to keep up this race between Malthus on the one hand and the productive farmer on the other hand, there are two things that can go wrong. In the social world, if you will, we can fail to continue our research, which would be an easy thing to do because we have abundance, but we must continue it if we're going to keep up this race. And we must do it in order to be able to cope with the surprising insects and so forth that will inevitably arise. The second thing that we have to keep our eye on is we have to be sure that we're getting the maximum amount of food, not only per acre, but per gallon of water. Because it is the water supply that is the lever by which climate can change food production. And the third point I would emphasize is we're now in this game not just to feed ourselves, but to do it in such a way that we spare acres and acres and acres for nature, a thing that I think everyone wants to do. That's my summary of where we stand. We can do it. We must persist in our research and development, even through good times. There's a saying, the only time you can save money is when you have it. We have to do our research while we have abundance, and we're doing this for nature as well as for ourselves.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. It's been very enlightening talking to you.
Thank you, Hugh.
I've been speaking today to Paul Wagoner, scientist at the Agricultural Experiment Station in Connecticut. This is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good day.